Welcome to Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to this week's episode of Physicians Weekly. I am your host, Dr. Rachel Giles, from Medical Medical Publishers in collaboration with Physicians Weekly.
Physicians Weekly offers in-depth interviews with the most highly respected experts in the medical community.
In this episode of Physicians Weekly's podcast, we speak with experts on two very contemporaneous topics in the news of late, the loneliness epidemic and the celebrity Alec Baldwin's case. First, I speak with Professor Carla Parisinotto. She's an associate medical director of Vitas Healthcare, and she's also a professor of geriatric medicine at UCSF in San Francisco. And she places the data she's published on social isolation and loneliness as medical issues in the context of the recent report by the U.S. Surgeon General stating that, quote, loneliness in older adults is a health priority, end quote. And this report received considerable media attention. You probably read about it. After that, we turn to a situation many doctors would not necessarily have thought was related to them at all. The charges were recently dropped against Alec Baldwin in the case of the death of a cinematographer who was killed on Alec Baldwin's movie set when a real bullet was fired instead of a blank. But charges are still pending against the armorer who loaded that gun that was given to him. Many doctors are confused about this. Does it actually suggest that if someone's assisting a doctor misinforms them about a patient or hands them the wrong medicine, that liability stops with that assistant? Our regular contributor, Dr. Medlaw, a board-certified radiologist and malpractice attorney, will answer some of those and other related questions. Enjoy listening. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Parisinotto. So I kind of love your name now. I'm going to pronounce it like that from now on.
There you go. I love it.
I really appreciate your time here today. And there's really an important topic that I wanted to talk to you in particular about, but perhaps you can explain who you are and a little bit about your research interests and what your professional capacity is in the clinic.
Sure. So I am a geriatrician and a palliative medicine physician. I have been providing care to predominantly homebound older adults for over a decade. And that includes people that are healthy. It also is for people with serious illness and life-limiting illness. So I provide care in a primary care capacity. And I also provide care for patients who are on hospice, which means that they have a prognosis of less than 6 months. So I'm a clinician first and foremost. And as part of that, you know, I do have a research career. And where that comes from is that I see things in my own patients and I wonder, how can I improve people's health and well-being? And that's really what brought me to studying and understanding, in my case, primarily loneliness, although really the intersection of loneliness and isolation is quite a bit. And I see that in my patients. And so I've been interested in understanding how loneliness affects older adults' ability to stay independent, their risk of mortality. And I'm also interested in what we do about it, since there's many community-based organizations that work with older adults. They have great programs, and I'm curious about whether they actually can impact people's health and well-being.
Oh, there's a lot to unpack here. So let's just start with the topic of loneliness here and social isolation. How do we measure that? And how can we actually see that whatever you're doing or is actually impacting that particular individual?
So great question. There actually are pretty standard definitions for loneliness and isolation. And this is important, and I appreciate you saying both loneliness and isolation because they are related but different. So loneliness is the subjective feeling of being alone. And social isolation is really more about the quantifiable number of relationships. So someone can have a lot of relationships, not be isolated, but still be lonely, and vice versa. There are standardized measures that we use. And in the United States, probably one of the most common measures we use for loneliness is something called the three-item loneliness questionnaire. It asks people if they feel left out, if they feel isolated, or if they lack companionship. And if you feel this all the time, that's more severe loneliness. If it's some of the time, it's more moderate or mild loneliness. For social isolation, there are also several different measures, some of the most common ones, and actually one recommended by the Institute of Medicine, to be included in electronic medical records so that clinicians can assess, something called the Berkman-Syme. So the importance of this is that they're standard definitions, they can be measured, and even for the busy clinicians and the busy primary care providers, this is something that can be done in practice. And I will highlight, if it's okay for your listeners, that my colleague and I, Julianne Holt-Lundstedt, who's a premier researcher in this space, we wrote a piece in the New England Journal of Medicine just, I think, about 2 months ago that outlined a framework for clinicians, something called EAR, with the idea that of listening, the listening ear. And so for the clinician to be able to, the E is the educate. So educate patients about the risks of loneliness and isolation. The A is for assess, so to use these standardized measures. And the R is for respond and reassess, which means you come in, I would say, Rachel, let me tell you a little bit about the risks of isolation and loneliness. I would assess you, so I have a score to track you over time, much like we do with other measures in healthcare. And then in a couple months, we might reassess you to see if what we've offered for you as a solution has actually made an impact.
And can you tell me about what is the frequency, what is the prevalence of loneliness and social isolation in adults over aged, I know, whatever your threshold would be, 65, 70?
Yeah, so in much like research, it all depends on what your sample size is. I will tell you that the initial research that I conducted in 2012 had a prevalence rate of 43% in people over the age of 60. And that's for any type of loneliness, okay? And that's paralleled in what the Surgeon General's report actually says. For social isolation, it's probably about 1 in 4 older adults. But again, these are not insignificant findings. And I think why this is important is that it's very prevalent. And we are seeing this in our practices. And probably even if we're not directly assessing, I have a feeling that many of us are seeing patients that haven't identified it themselves or feel uncomfortable talking about it in clinic. Or maybe we as clinicians don't know how to talk about it.
You mentioned the Surgeon General's recent report. Could you go back to that a little bit and tell me what was your interpretation of that report? And was it a call for action? And if so, how can we as clinicians respond appropriately?
Yes. And I will say that for disclosure, I was one of the reviewers for the Surgeon General's advisory. So I was very excited to finally see this come out.
Yeah, so important.
You know, it follows up on a 2020 report from the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine, which was I was also a part of, that demonstrated that, you know, as a healthcare sector, this is the, I'm going back to 2020, the National Academy's report, the healthcare sector needs to not ignore this topic. So we have that report out, then we have 3 years of a pandemic, and we have the Surgeon General who has very openly discussed his own experience with loneliness. And again, really focused on the evidence for the dramatic health effects and absolutely a call to action that this is a public health priority in our country and even globally, we can say. And I know that, for example, the World Health Organization is also starting to tackle this topic. What I do love about the Surgeon General's report is that it's very, if you can get through the multiple pages, it's actually very accessible and there are some wonderful tables in there. And there's it really outlines why this is a priority, but also what we can do at a systemic level. He talks a lot about there being 6 pillars of social connection, and it's really about strengthening the fabric of our connection. So to go through the 6 pillars, the first one is about strengthening social infrastructure in our individual communities. So that means that there's a local part of the solution that needs to happen. Number 2 is actually enacting pro-connection public policies. So this is more globally. The 3rd is mobilizing the health sector, which very much dovetails on the National Academy of Sciences report. The 4th is really rethinking about digital environments and how does our interaction with technology in our digital world help or hinder our social connections. The 5th is deepening our knowledge. And then the 6th is building a culture of connection.
So important. Okay. And I'm a bit curious about the 5th one. I don't really understand what deepening our knowledge will be exactly. What does that refer to exactly? Is that like research, stimulating research in the area?
I think there's a couple things. It's research and it's also public awareness in that there's certainly been more media attention, but it hasn't been sustained and it has not been translated into the knowledge base having a complete national agenda and really public health campaigns, if anything, about for us as individuals recognizing that we need to prioritize our social health and our social connection if we do want to have prosperous, independent, long lives. So it's increasing awareness, it's furthering the research, but the research, I would say, not on the health effects, that's very understood, but it's the research in terms of, okay, we know this is a health effect, which programs, which solutions are actually the ones that work.
Right. And so give me some insight. How will this translate outside of the states as well? And will it translate within the states among communities?
I think it's both. And I think there's one, it's understanding, you're absolutely right, depending on where you live, how people form social connections is different. And I was in Europe in early this year, and I was just amazed at how just the way our cities are structured and the center of the family and after dinner, everyone's walking outside together, very different than what's happening here. So there is that part, but it's an understanding of, okay, I've identified myself as lonely. Are there supports in my community that I can turn to enhance my social connection? And are those programs or are there relationships that I could develop individually? And that is my responsibility. But is there also a responsibility, for example, of health plans and our insurers and our government to actually say, hey, if this is impacting my health, is it a multi-stakeholder response to help me do that? For example, if we have a comparison of smoking, and there's a lot of comparisons made to the health effects of smoking compared to social connection, which are pretty similar, there's a lot of public health dollars spent on smoking cessation and prevention. Well, should we be dedicating that same amount of funding towards social connection?
Understand. And what are some of the experiences that you've had with interventions? Could you describe what some of those look like? It's kind of hard for many people to imagine.
Yeah, so I think that there's a couple ways to phrase this. And again, you know, what's tricky about this space is that there is this part as an individual, I need to be a part of the solution and what I do about it, right? So it's not just for someone else to solve. But at the same time, to put the onus only on the individual, that's not fair either. So it's trying to find that balance. I've had the fortune of working with several different community organizations, and I'll highlight one because it's a published paper where we have evidence behind the intervention. So this intervention is with a program called the Curry Senior Center here in San Francisco, situated in the Tenderloin in downtown San Francisco, which unfortunately currently has been being highlighted because it's a neighborhood with premature aging, high comorbid illness with coexisting psychiatric illness, a lot of unstable housing. And what we did in this program is found that there were many older adults who were likely isolated and in need of connection. There was some funding from the Mental Health Services Act. The goal was to connect the older adults to services. However, what we found is that the older adults just needed another person to connect with, a peer. So it's called a peer intervention. So we paired clients over a year, and over a year we found reductions in feelings of loneliness, reductions in the barriers to social isolation or to isolation, and reductions in depression. So this is really neat to see the evidence behind this. And the question is, are these programs that can scale and can translate into other communities? And that's where hopefully getting some more funding so that we can expand these programs and see them at scale and see how to replicate in other settings.
That's really fascinating. Are there other cultures where geriatric social isolation is not as prevalent?
There are.
That we can learn from best practices?
Yeah. So there's been a term called the blue zones, which you may or may not have heard. But the blue zones were actually started with other academic research before they were called blue zones. But it was actually realizing that these are communities where people have long life expectancies up to 100 years old. And what they found in these areas is that longevity was based on absolutely social connection. And it's really because when the town structures are more geared towards socially connected, there's a focus on, you know, good food, movement, and connection. And I think it's really about what we value and how the cities are set up and how people's work are set up and the value of, you know, intergenerational households as well. That's probably oversimplifying.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating topic. So what are some of the next steps now the Surgeon General letter's out? It made big ripples around the world. Mm-hmm. And it's very much a call to action, like you said. So what do we do next? What are the next steps?
Oh, so many different things. But what I do hope, and I'll probably narrow my scope and my answer a little bit here more towards our healthcare sector, is that we've been talking a lot for a while about how to standardize this in healthcare. And I actually do think that's one of the next steps, is that if we do not measure this, if we don't include this in our standardized encounters with patients, we're not going to move anywhere. We don't know what we're missing. And I think it can be very daunting, to be frank. And I think we have a crisis in healthcare right now with primary care providers feeling very overstretched and feeling this is one more thing to do. But I think the argument is that we are actually spending a lot of time on things that may not have the same impact on someone's life as social connection. And social connection may actually be a way to get better health outcomes. And it may be a way for us to better connect with our patients. And it's amazing that I've seen that in practice, and then I see it played out in the research. So that's one of the things. So more integration into our health system, which includes the electronic medical record. And then I think the next steps from there are these ideas about social prescribing, which actually Europe is a little bit more advanced in, that saying, you know, I do identify someone who's lonely. I'd like to have a social prescription. Is that evidence-based? And then, of course, the policies that fall behind there in the United States, especially where we're not a single-payer healthcare system, but where we have a multimodal payment system where we need to have some buy-in from our health plans. And we do have some, but it's how to maintain that.
Okay. So I just wanted to thank you very much for your time. Is there anything else you want to share with fellow clinicians about this topic that's important to get out there?
I think the message is that it can be very hard as a primary care physician because there's so many different measures, but it's incredible how impactful this can be in terms of our relationships with our patients and their longevity and well-being, really by talking about the importance of connection.
Okay, well, continue doing the great research and the great work. I'm looking forward to seeing the next New England Journal of Medicine paper. So anyway, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Physicians Weekly is back again with our regular contributor, Dr. Medlaw, a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice attorney. This time, to discuss the implications of the Alec Baldwin case for doctors. Dr. Medlaw, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be here.
The charges were dropped against Alec Baldwin in the case of the death of the cinematographer who was killed on his movie set when a real bullet was fired instead of a blank. But charges are still pending against the armorer who loaded the gun that was given to him. Many doctors are confused about this. Does it suggest that if someone assisting a doctor misinforms them about a patient or hands them a wrong medicine, that liability stops with that assistant?
Well, the criminal case was actually dropped because the prop gun, it turned out, had been modified in a way that made it possible to fire without the trigger being pulled, which was exactly what Baldwin had been saying, that he never pulled the trigger. So the prosecutor determined she couldn't make an involuntary manslaughter case based on these actual facts. So that's why it was dropped. However, and this is what doctors care about, the allegations about his civil liability, because he was a producer on the film. The ones that were made in the civil suits that he either has settled or is settling, those do cast light on the situation that a doctor working in a setting in which they're being assisted by other staff can actually face.
Is a doctor who is a fiduciary for their patient under an enhanced responsibility for their safety in this sort of situation?
No. Merely being the doctor in, you know, these multiplayer medical settings doesn't elevate your responsibility to a level of near or actual perfection. And, you know, just as Baldwin, he wasn't a fiduciary, he was still responsible for a safe set, would never have been held to a standard that there could never be any accidents or injuries at all. However, a doctor is expected to act as a reasonably prudent fiduciary for the patient under the actual circumstances that include working with someone else who might make an error.
So how does this get addressed?
It would be a series of three sequential questions. The first to establish if there could be a negligence claim, and then two more to examine the doctor's role.
What is the first question?
Well, that would be, was the error foreseeable? And that's the essential issue in any negligence case. An alleged tortfeasor, you know, the one who's alleged to have committed the tort, is only responsible for what can foreseeably be caused by their negligent act or negligent omission. We don't hold someone responsible for ripples and iterations.
So how does it play out in the analysis?
In the Baldwin case, it was certainly foreseeable that a live round might get loaded and then cause harm if it was fired. So if Baldwin, as a producer, failed to take reasonable steps to prevent that, he could be civilly liable. In the same way that someone assisting a doctor could make an error in providing information or treatment items that could harm a patient is foreseeable. So the essential predicate for negligence liability, that'll be present.
What is the next question?
That would be, was the doctor the actual cause of the error? So this would be analogous to the claim that Baldwin, as a producer, it was running a really slipshod set because he wanted to make filming go faster and save money. So a doctor who can be shown to have created or perpetuated a clinical environment in which the chance of that error was enhanced, for example, you know, they're rushing the staff or they're discouraging them from asking questions or, you know, for checking, well, they could have liability for that.
But what if it is the facility that is doing so? For example, allotting too little time for a patient evaluation or tracking patients away from direct physician supervision?
Well, that's a great question because, in the modern world, doctors often don't really choose the environment in which they practice. And the answer is that in that situation, the doctor wouldn't be responsible for a system they didn't actually control. But if there was a lawsuit or a board complaint, they would want to show that they took all due care that they could within that system.
What is the next question?
Well, that would be, could the doctor have prevented the error by themselves exercising reasonable care? And that answer would depend on what hat the doctor is wearing.
What do you mean by that?
When it's someone else earlier in the chain of care who's making the error, the first issue is whether the doctor could have been what the law calls the last clear chance to catch that error. Now, that would apply to any doctor who's working with someone else, you know, whether or not they set the parameters of the work. The next issue will be if the doctor actually had a role in setting the conditions in which the error occurred. So this would address, you know, the practices and protocols that they either established or facilitated, you know, the choices that they made among all possible choices on how to best deliver care. And again, that would be analogous to Baldwin's producer role, where he could have made safety practice decisions for the set that were better.
So what would be the standard in that case?
In negligence law, you're not compared to perfection. It would be an assessment against what a reasonably prudent practitioner who is aware of the foreseeability of a type of error would set in place to avoid that error occurring in those actual circumstances. So Baldwin was criticized for cutting corners on safety for guns and ammunition. So he would fall short on that. And so would a doctor who has lax or confusing practices.
But what if the other staff, the ones who actually made the error, are facility employees and work under protocols that the doctor does not set?
Well, the doctor still has a non-delegable duty of patient safety. So maybe they can't accept that staff, or maybe they can't follow those protocols as they are and have to make modifications. This actually overlaps with something we discussed in another podcast, the current application of the captain of the ship doctrine. That used to be about when a doctor was, you know, almighty and could just order around hospital staff as though they were their employees. But how it's applied now means that if the doctor at least has the authority to act in a way that can avert a foreseeably dangerous event, that they can be held liable for not taking the step that they could have taken. So a typical example would be if you're doing a complicated surgery and, you know, things are very, you know, rough and tough in the procedure, doing a second sponge count, even if the hospital doesn't routinely require that that be done.
It sounds like we are coming back to reasonability.
Exactly. That's where we always land. If you're working with someone whom you know and the schedule's not overly busy, then trusting in what they tell you or what they hand you is reasonable. But when you're working with someone unfamiliar or less trained or things are running hot, then taking extra care is reasonable. That being said, though, it can be reasonable to just assume the possibility of human error all the time. You know, you can call it the Reagan rule of liability avoidance. Trust, but verify. For example, you'll never be sorry that you did a second sponge count on every case. Or how about a situation more like, you know, Baldwin being handed a preloaded gun? You go into a procedure room and the procedure tray is laid out and someone else filled the syringes. In that situation, requiring that all bottles that were used be kept out to be shown to you is a good idea, even if you're working with a team whom you think is great. You know, Baldwin would never have been expected to empty every prop gun and check each round personally, and you don't have to dump the syringes and refill them yourself, but you'd want to have prudent safeguards in place.
So what about documentation? What should be in a note?
Well, as we always say, the chart doesn't say that something was done. When the lawsuit or the board complaint comes through, it wasn't done. You know, testimonially swearing that was done never makes up for the lack of a note in a setting in which a reasonable juror or board examiner would expect to see a note. So what do? You write stuff down. If you are following a facility or personal protocol that has a safety step, say that you followed that step. You know, say something like, as per protocol, all bottles on the prep tray were reviewed and their use in preparing the syringes was verified with technologist Jane Jones, who had filled them. You know, if you add a personal step to a facility protocol, say that you added it, you know, something like, before infusing, the contents of the syringe were verified with nurse Sam Smith, who filled it.
Can you accept a supervisor's statement?
Not unless they personally observed the action. This actually overlaps with the Baldwin case because an assistant director gave him the gun and said that it was okay, but doesn't appear to have actually watched the loading. Now, note that in both examples that we just hypothesized about, the verification was directly with the person on whom the doctor was relying. A statement that, oh, everything's fine, from a supervisor who didn't actually see the action in question will never be an adequate defense. Now, of course, if you accept a supervisor's account based on what they observed, then note that they did observe it. So in that situation, you would say something like, you know, OR supervisor Mary Rowe, who had observed the preparation of the syringes, verified their contents.
How about relying on a checklist?
Well, that's, again, a great question, since many hospitals have these. And the answer is a checklist is only as good as the actual knowledge of those who signed it. You could have had 1,000 checklists on the movie set and the AD could have signed it, but the fact was he really didn't know about how the gun was loaded. So direct verification of a critical step, particularly one close to your entry in the chain of care, the person who's telling you something about a patient or handing you a vial, is preferable if you can possibly do it. If you are relying on a checklist, though, mention that you reviewed it.
So can you summarize this?
Sure. You as a doctor, you're going to be seen as the last clear chance to avert error from a harm earlier in the chain of medical care in which multiple hands have played a part. As a fiduciary, you're going to carry your own non-delegable duty to act in the best interests of your patient to avoid a foreseeable harm. And this applies when you set the parameters under which the care is delivered, and when those parameters are set for you. What will actually satisfy your duties will be assessed on the reasonability standard under the actual circumstances, and safety steps, whether they're routine or whether you added them, and verification with staff should always be documented.
Dr. Medlaw, thank you as always for joining us.
Well, thanks for a chance to talk about this important topic.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Physicians Weekly Podcast. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.